So, important point number one. This is a quote that you hear frequently. When methane is burned, it produces about half the amount of CO2 as burning coal and oil. And that is mentioned to you often by utility representatives as if it's a good thing. However, when it leaks or is emitted into the atmosphere before being burned, it does a great deal more damage, and that's a bad thing. And so the trade-off is the good stuff versus the bad stuff. And in some circumstances, the bad can outweigh the good. So you want to pay attention to the word burned or leaked. The second point I want to make is that EPA publishes obsolete data. And many journalists will go to the EPA website and quote directly from it. And there are far more reliable scientific sources. It's not EPA's fault. They're bound by convention. And I'm going to let some of the other speakers explain that. I'm not trying to beat up EPA. I'm just trying to help you go to the correct source. I'm going to give you an example of that. This is from the EPA website this morning. And it talks about greenhouse gas issues. And it says, pound for pound, the comparative impact of methane is more than 25 times greater over a 100-year period. And there is the footnote right off the EPA website. However, I want to draw your attention to the 25 times and the date. Again, right off the EPA website this morning. The IPPC has updated their information in a 2013 report, which is now 5 years old, and it says that a 100-year impact is 34. The 100-year impact is 34. So if you go to the EPA website, the difference between 25 and 34 is actually quite significant. The other thing is that the EPA website, unless you really dig into it, focuses on the 100-year impact. And there's no scientific argument for selecting the 100-year impact as far as methane is concerned, because the 20-year impact is a great deal more. And the life of methane is somewhere in the, not the life, but the impactful life on the same common scale, is about 12 and a half years. So if you use EPA's 100-year impact, it is possible to have the reader underestimate the value of fixing something or calling it to public attention. And when you're in covering regulatory process, this happens a lot. Whoops. So the 100-year impact is the big blue bar, and it's expressed as EPA expressed it. But at 12 and a half, the impact looks like that.
Hey, Fran.
Sir.
Can you use the mic?
No, the microphones are not working.
They are recording.
Yeah.
It's not for the...
They're not for projecting.
Correct.
Do I need to project more?
No, the projecting is fine.
The microphone also for recording.
Oh. Okay, I beg your pardon. I had been briefed that they were using the microphones for recording, but it never occurred to me that I was being recorded. So the last point here is when you're covering a story about methane, whether it's leakage or cow farts or whatever it is, bear in mind how it impacts. So here's a slide of methane leakage in New York City and how the New York Times covered this in 2015 using the same data that is on the website today. You'll see that it's 20 times more potent. The Wall Street Journal reports the same thing as 25 times more potent. These are both 100-year estimates of impact. But it's not covered that way, and that's a key piece of vocabulary that I want you to take away. Okay, I'm now going to switch, sit down. I've been coached on how to make this work. Oh, sorry, Sabrina, you're next, aren't
That's
you?
Okay.
I beg your pardon. Do you mind leaving that up while you talk?
I don't, just so no one's confused. I'm the ill-prepared one in the group who did not put anything up on the screen, so I get no credit for that, or I'll take all the credit for that, depending. So my name's Sabrina Shankman. I'm a reporter at Inside Climate News, where I write about the Arctic, although we all write about climate change in different capacities all the time. But so for the last, like, year and a half or so, I've been focusing that reporting on short-lived climate pollutants. I don't know how familiar everyone is with that term, but methane is kind of the big offender when we talk about short-lived climate pollutants. But what we're talking about is things like methane, black carbon, tropospheric ozone, HFCs, like, you know, the things that have contributed to the hole in the ozone layer, that are more potent than carbon dioxide, but they don't live in the atmosphere for quite as long. And, you know, they're all really nasty. There's a lot of, as we know, there's a lot of depressing things. When it comes to reporting on climate change, it can be a pretty bleak beat. But I find that short-lived climate pollutants is a little bit of a hopeful angle within this. And that's because as you talk to scientists and policymakers, what they'll explain is that, you know, because these don't live for a century or more in the way that carbon dioxide does, if you can find a way to tackle short-lived climate pollutants, you can find a way to make a difference in our lifetime. It doesn't take away the onus or pressure to deal with the CO2 problem, because obviously that is the most pressing issue that we're facing when it comes to climate change. But maybe it buys a little time. So that's what brought me to methane. You know, as Fran said, methane lives for about like 12-ish years in the atmosphere. It's long enough so that, you know, what's emitted in Texas is impacting the entire world. It's what's called globally mixed, so it goes up in the atmosphere, and it impacts everything. But short enough that, you know, regulations and changes made in the near term can really make a pretty significant difference. So the reason that I look at it through the Arctic is because what happened, you know, as we all know, the Arctic is experiencing profound changes from climate change. And it's this very, like, intricate, sensitive system where we're able to really see, you know, what's going on right now. So what, for instance, what the Arctic Council's AMAP group has found is that methane contributions globally have resulted in roughly a half a degree Celsius of warming since pre-industrial times in the Arctic already. So it's not a hypothetical. It's really, you know, having a pretty big impact up there already. So Dan and David are both going to go more into depth on some of those issues. So the other thing that's interesting when it comes to methane and the Arctic is it's not just about what sources like the oil and gas industry and agriculture, landfills are emitting. It's also about some of the natural sources that are up there already, namely the permafrost. Are people familiar with what permafrost is generally? Okay, so it's massive amounts of carbon stored in frozen ground in the Arctic. And as things are heating up, what scientists have been measuring is the temperature of the permafrost is creeping ever closer to the thawing point. And in certain places, it is already starting to thaw. You know, the science is really emerging still on just how much carbon is locked up there, how much methane is going to be released. It's actually evolving at the point now where when the IPCC put together its 2015 assessment, which is the most recent report that they came out with, they didn't have any good science on this. They weren't able to take into account what's in the permafrost, which means our climate projections, dire as they already are lacking this major component. And the reason that's significant is, like, earlier this year, NSIDC, the National Snow and Ice Data Center, reported that, you know, the amount of carbon locked in the permafrost greatly exceeds the amount of carbon that's in the atmosphere already. So it's not small potatoes here. It's a big deal. So, but, you know, we are waiting on people like Dan and the other smart folks to figure it out so that people like David and I can write about it and see what's going to happen. So that's the doom and gloom side of things. But like I mentioned, you know, short-lived climate pollutants do offer this like glimmer of hope. And that's why they became, methane in particular, became such a target of the Obama administration in trying to achieve, set us on a pathway to achieve the goals of the Paris Agreement. The Obama administration spent about 2 years hammering out a fairly intricate set of rules to help us tackle methane. And they're actually like pretty simple concepts. It's things like plugging leaks, limiting the venting and flaring of gas, and upping the number of inspections for certain kinds of equipment so that those leaks are definitely caught. And as they were working on this, they had a pretty diverse set of allies, you know, obviously scientists, policymakers, but also the industry. Because for the industry, leaking methane represents lost profits. So it's totally a win-win for the industry because they can support increased regulations, and that makes, you know, gives the very real appearance of kind of greening their business model while also saving them some money. So they were on board for that. But then the Trump administration came in and things changed. And so, as we know, the Obama's climate legacy has kind of been front and center in the Trump administration's crosshairs to dismantle those. And the methane rules have kind of been a main target of that. And so there's been this kind of step-by-step attempt to dismantle. And in certain cases, it's been pretty successful. So, like, for instance, just earlier this month, the Interior Department finalized a rule to roll back requirements that the industry detect and capture methane leaks from public lands and that they pay royalties on it. So when the Obama administration had come up with that rule, they had found that roughly $330 million a year are lost to taxpayers based on natural gas royalties that could be collected from this. So, but the Trump administration basically said, well, the states already have laws and, you know, it's putting too much pressure on the private sector, so we're good. Earlier in September, there was another rule that was proposed by the EPA dealing with new oil and gas operations on private lands, basically saying, like, we don't need as much monitoring and giving a lot of exemptions to the regulations. So this is sort of like continuing of a theme. Like, if you spend a lot of time looking at methane, you can see a number of these examples. Now, the environmental community has been fighting back. So there's a lot of rule changes that get proposed and then lawsuits that follow on their heels. So kind of TBD on just how far this will all get rolled back. But there's definitely been, a lot of backward steps when it comes to regulating methane in the recent years. But fortunately, the U.S. isn't the only country in the world. So like in Canada, they've been making some progress toward regulating methane. Earlier this year, they passed some new federal air pollution regulations that would cut methane by 40 to 45% by 2025. And they're not alone. Other countries are also stepping up their games on this front. So I am going to wrap up in a minute. I just wanted to, for those who are interested in reporting on methane, a couple of key sources. First off, like Fran mentioned, EPA website is not the place to go to link to or to cite when it comes to talking about methane. So in case anybody wants to jot it down, in the appendix of the IPCC's AR5 report, you can find the graph, the table that shows this question of, you know, a lifetime of like how methane compares to CO2 in terms of potency. So you can look and see, well, it doesn't make sense to look at methane over a 100-year time scale because it doesn't live for that long. If we look at a shorter time scale, more immediate, we're looking at 20 years, and it's 86 times more potent. That's what you can link to. The IPCC's AR5 report. So it was the one that came out in 2015, which is the most recent one. And then in terms of people to call, Ceres in Boulder, which is this collaboration between NOAA and CU Boulder, is a great source. They're full of scientists that love to talk about this stuff and really know what they're talking about. Dan is a good person to call. He's a person that I've called in my reporting. And then there's a handful of like NGO environmental groups. Earthworks, which is currently in the House, is doing some work on that. EDF, has been a leader in doing studies about this. You know, I think the best move for me has been to read the EDF studies and then, rather than calling EDF necessarily, call the scientists who are listed on there, because they can give you perhaps a more clean telling of what the science is. You know, there's not a any kind of lens that they're seeing that through. Not that, not to knock EDF, because they do great work and they're always very helpful. Climate and Clean Air Coalition, which was launched by the UN Environment Program to tackle short-lived climate pollutants. And finally, the Clean Air Task Force, which is doing a lot of work internationally with different countries to help implement plans to tackle methane and other short-lived climate pollutants as well, would all be places that I would say would be really helpful. And that is it.
You finished early.
With a minute to spare.
Thank you.
All yours.
Thank you. So I'm going to stand up here, I think.
Okay. Do I use the arrows or something? Let's start the slideshow. Actually, I will go right to the bottom there. Just
right here. Great. Good. And I can just use down arrows?
Okay.
Okay, great. So Dan Zimmerle from Colorado State University. As the first slide showed this entire time, we've been chasing methane emission leaks for about 8 years now. We've had completely brown hair at that point. We work a lot with industry, but we've also worked a lot with the environmental community. So we've worked with EDF, we've worked with industry. My team and I kind of counted up the other day. We've been on about 700 oil and gas sites in the last 6 years making measurements. So we've done those in cooperation with sites. We've also done downwind without their cooperation. And then in addition to that, we run a test facility for new methane solutions, what I like to call Hollywood well pads, because they kind of look like well pads and they emit like well pads, but they're completely fake. Okay. And they look so realistic, actually, I figured out about 6 months into it that everybody was going to come shoot their promotional videos there. So we put big logos on the tanks that say CSU on them. Okay. So if you see a promotional video from a solution and you see a big ram's head on it, that was shot at our site. Okay. And you too can have a site for $4.5 million. So I want to talk a little bit about what we know about natural gas emissions. So that we being writ large, not just me. Okay, about 2010, when the interest in kind of emissions from the gas infrastructure started, our estimates of how much gas was leaking between well and use was about 0.5 or 12%, somewhere in that range. Okay. Over the last 6 years, 7 years, we've been able to hammer that down to about 1.7 to 2.3%, with some people still out on the right and some people still out on the left, okay, on that spectrum. But that's the 1.7%, you know, the references are in there. 1.7% comes from NEDL, National Energy Technology Lab, and the one on the right comes from the latest EDF study that was published in Science this summer. As a reference point, if you convert coal-fired electric generation to natural gas, the best effort or best information we have that if you have a leak rate less than 3%, gas is better. And if you have a leak rate more than 3%, gas would be worse. Okay? So right now we're kind of on the right side of that line. Okay? Probably the most aggressive U.S. energy company coalition is One Future, and they're targeting to get down to 1% across the supply chain. OGCI is less, Oil and Gas Climate Initiative, is a little bit less aggressive, but they have sort of a similar level. So that's kind of what we know. Let me talk a little bit about how we know that. Okay. So in order to know what our emissions are, we can't go out and do measurements in one way. So the best studies that we've been able to do, we measure at multiple levels. We go on-site, we measure individual devices. We go downwind to the site, we measure the flux coming out of the site, out of the facility. And then we fly aircraft around, or we put towers around, we do regional types of measurements. If you don't do all three of those, you never really know if you got everything. Okay? So what we've been doing over time is to look at how you do those measurements. And the slides up here, this is from a paper colleague of mine at NOAA, Stefan Schweitzke, Gabriella Petron, and we did a three-level study in the Fayetteville Shale. The final paper is going to be released on the 22nd of October, just a few days from now. And what we did is we measured the emissions by flying aircraft around the entire production basin. We flew upwind, kind of measured the blue line across the top, measured what was coming in, flew on the downwind side, measured the flux going out, do some math. Okay, you can figure out how much is generated. Okay, and if you see a measurement like this in your reporting, you're going to see one or two fuzzy numbers. We flew for 15 days. We had 2 days that were successful. We got two measurements each day. Four measurements, 15 days. Okay? And that's kind of what it looks like. The other way we calculate emissions, we go from the bottom up. We either measure at the facility level or we go on site and we measure individual leaks and we add these up. So you go, you measure, you multiply the number of leaks. That's called an activity factor. You multiply those by the amount of emissions per leak. That's an emissions factor. Okay, you do that statistical multiply. I mean, we're not just literally multiplying the center value. We're multiplying a distribution. And you add that all up, and that's called a bottom-up estimate. Okay, the greenhouse gas inventory is a bottoms-up estimate. So people have gone around. They've collected information about individual leaks. They've made a guess about the activity data. They've multiplied them together. They came up with a number. When you see a pie chart like the one on the lower right that's in the EPA website, that was the way that was done. Okay? Couple of points about bottoms up. Okay? One of the problems with bottoms up is that we never quite get enough samples to know what the largest emitters are or how frequent they are. Okay, we call that the long tail or the super emitter. It's got a bunch of other names, right? The second problem with the bottoms up is we oftentimes have less information about the activity than we do about the emissions measurement. Okay, oddly enough, it is very hard to establish the number of gathering compressor stations in the U.S., someplace between about 5,000 and 6,500. Okay, we don't actually know that number. Nobody reports that. Okay, so when you're looking at this kind of information, we get pretty good actionable data. We know which areas have larger emissions than which other areas. Okay, but there's always a chance of missing something. That makes sense? Okay, so if you look at this type of technique, you find everything. Okay, but you only get snapshot emissions. Okay, on this guy, you get lots of actionable information, but there's holes in it. Okay, so this quick summary slide, so for reference, and I've got some handouts here you can all pick up about who uses what. Okay, so if you look at IPCC, for example, what they do is a bottoms-up estimate that's sort of calibrated by tops-down measurements, usually satellite-type level measurements, okay? EPA greenhouse gas inventory is completely a bottoms-up estimate. They don't have a constraining top-down reference to that, okay? So let's go back to the estimates and talk a little bit about how we know what we know, okay? So if you look back at 2010, those low estimates were based on bottoms up only, using old emissions factors primarily collected in the 1990s and 1980s. Okay? The top down estimates were based on one of two models. They went to a single basin and did an aircraft measurement, or they guessed. Okay? Flat out guessed. Okay? They made a bunch of assumptions, okay, said the emissions factors were wrong. They guessed, and they came up with a number around there. Okay? In fact, some of the papers that did flat-out guessing still ping around a lot in articles today, even though pretty much been, from an academic perspective, pretty much discredited. Okay. Now, as we squeeze down toward today, what we've been able to do is to do combination studies of in three areas. We've done better bottoms up, so we have more measurements. They're more recent, and they reflect more current site designs for natural gas. We also have much better activity data. We have not gotten that from the government. We've gotten that by working with operators and having them give us counts, and then we guess what our non-partners had as well. Okay, there's a couple holes. We still don't know very much about large emitters. Inside the meter, we don't know much about. There's a couple of other areas where we're a bit weak. And then on the top-down side, we've also gotten better regional measurements. We now have something along the line of about 15 regional mass balance measurements that have helped us constrain that down quite a bit. Okay, so 10 years, 8 years, we managed to squeeze that number down by an order of magnitude, basically, in range at this point. Okay, a couple of conclusions. So first one is, what do we know? So we know that methane is a significant greenhouse gas, previously been covered. One of the things to keep in mind is oil and gas is a significant contributor of methane, but it's still only a third. In the U.S., it's one-third. If you go outside the U.S., it actually becomes even less because the agricultural, the rest of the world isn't as energy intensive as we are. On the methane front. And so, second, we've been able to squeeze down that estimate, okay? Personally, I would appreciate it if people took the more recent estimates. I think we have a better idea rather than stuff from 5 years ago, okay? And the last point, the one I want to make the most is watch what you're covering, okay? There's top-down studies, okay, they fly at a certain period of time. They get a snapshot. Literally, the snapshot of their emissions is in the order of several minutes long, okay? And whatever was happening in the basin at that point of time affects what they see, okay? And they get this one fuzzy measurement, okay? If you're talking to somebody like me who primarily does bottoms up, you need to be asking me what assumptions I made. Because I had to fill holes. Everybody in my business is filling holes in their data. Okay? So when you're talking to us, ask us what assumption we made. Okay? Where was it that you did not have data and you had to fill in? Okay? Because we all have to do that. Okay? It's better to fill the hole and get closer to the answer than to not fill the hole and do a deflated number. Okay? But you need to know where we're filling those holes. Thank you.
Okay, my name is David Abel. I am a reporter at the Boston Globe, where I have covered the impact of gas leaks on a range of issues over the last few years. I'm going to take a slightly different tack here, and I'm going to more tell you a bit of a story that starts this way. 22 days ago, on a mild afternoon, when many people were on their way home from work, an emergency dispatcher in northeastern Massachusetts received what was an otherwise unremarkable phone call. It was about a basement fire. A few minutes later, another dispatcher in another town received another call about a fire, and then another one came into another dispatcher. The calls kept coming in. There were reports about homes being leveled, people trapped under rubble, fires seemingly everywhere. Within a half hour, authorities issued a grave order over the police radio. Get every civilian out of this area, they said. On September 13th, three communities in the Merrimack Valley, north of Boston, experienced more than 80 fires and explosions that left one teenage man dead, at least 25 others injured, and dozens of properties destroyed. Tens of thousands of people were evacuated and weren't allowed to return to their homes for days. More than 8,000 people in these communities still lack power and soon heat. and it's unclear still when they'll get it back. One local fire chief described the scene as what looked like Armageddon. What happened? The truth is, at this point, we still don't know. Officials at the National Transportation Safety Board, which is investigating, said they're looking at whether there was a surge of pressure in the network of natural gas pipes that led to the homes. Did a sensor fail? Did a worker turn a valve the wrong way? Was it an act of malice? Again, we don't know. Here's what we do know. Natural gas is flammable, and in just the right amounts, it can turn a pilot light into a blowtorch. Anything from the flick of a switch to a cell phone call can spark an explosion. We also know that gas leaks are common, especially in states like Massachusetts, where some of the pipes are more than a century old. At last count, the natural gas distribution system in Massachusetts had nearly 16,000 leaks, according to the utilities. While the vast majority of those leaks do not pose a threat, we know some of them can be exceptionally dangerous, and we know that there's little warning of when they become dangerous. 6 years before the explosions in the Merrimack Valley, a gas leak that occurred when a worker accidentally punctured a gas line in Springfield, Massachusetts, leveled a strip club, injuring 21 people. A few years earlier, in Lexington, Massachusetts, an erroneous work order led a crew to connect a high-pressure gas line to a low-pressure line, triggering the destruction of a house and fires in seven others. Similar incidents have happened all over the country. In 2010, San Bruno, California, as many may know, eight people died when a leak occurred in a 30-inch pipeline that led to an explosion so big that it was registered by federal authorities as an earthquake. Beyond the physical dangers, we also know there are serious environmental consequences to gas leaks. We know they contaminate groundwater, kill trees, and the benzene in them can be carcinogenic. And of course, the reason why we're here, they contribute to climate change. They contribute significant amounts of greenhouse gas emissions. But what we don't know exactly how much, as Dan was saying, they contribute, and that in a place like the Boston area, which has very specific rules on and laws about how much we need to cut emissions, is a big problem. By most accounts, they're underestimated. In Massachusetts, which has mostly phased out the use of coal and oil, natural gas now accounts for at least 36% of the state's overall carbon emissions, more than double the amount of what it was in 1990. But last year, the state's utilities reported that they either couldn't account for or lost through accidents or leaks nearly 2% of the gas they distributed in the state. Those estimates, however, are not based on actual measurements. And scientists who have actually measured the state's gas leaks say that figure is significantly higher. In fact, a study released a few years ago by scientists at Harvard found that the amount of methane leaking from natural gas pipelines in Massachusetts was as much as 3 times greater than had been previously estimated. The scientists said those leaks amounted to enough to heat as many as 200,000 homes a year and were valued at some $90 million, which, of course, ratepayers will bear and are bearing. We also know that the utilities have often undercounted the number of gas leaks in the state, either through a failure to detect them or dubious reporting practices. 2 years ago, I reported in the Globe how 5,700 leaks, nearly 30% of all the leaks that went unrepaired in 2014, had vanished from the utility's reported count between the last day of the year and the first day of the new year. Local advocacy groups have found similar discrepancies in more recent years. Utility companies have said some of those leaks were no longer emitting gas, but that and other explanations continue to seem, to me, unlikely. We also know that many of the leaks that the utilities do report have been issuing gas for a very long time. One leak not far from Fenway Park in Boston has been seeping emissions since Ronald Reagan was president. It became so absurd that local activists held a birthday party to celebrate the leak, including balloons, glittery hats, and a vanilla frosted cake. They, of course, did not bring a match to light a candle. We also know that some leaks emit more emissions than others. An estimated 7% of the leaks, which Dan referred to as super emitters, account for about half of all the greenhouse gases produced by the state's natural gas leaks. The problem is that utilities don't really have an efficient way of finding the super emitters. And because no one really knows how much gas is being leaked into the atmosphere from all these old pipes, the state really can't say for sure how much it's reducing its overall emissions. That has raised significant questions about the state's accounting of its greenhouse gases and its ability to comply with our law, which requires that Massachusetts emissions fall 25% below 1990 levels by the end of the decade. In a recent paper, scientists from Harvard and Boston University found that the failure to accurately tabulate the amount of gas seeping from the state's pipes suggests that the state is not only underestimating its overall emissions, but potentially creating a false sense of progress with overly rosy reports. Ultimately, the scientists said, those failures mean that the existing approach to counting emissions omits so much data that cities, states, and nations are effectively flying blind, unaware of how much greenhouse gases they're actually producing. In the long run, that may be just as dangerous as scores of houses exploding in one day. Thank you.
I want to thank our panelists.
The expertise here is stunning. I invite you now, we have about a half
hour for you to dig down deep. Preference on raising questions goes to the Society of Environmental Journalists first, and we will adjourn promptly at 12:50. Sir. Could you introduce yourself, please?
Dan.
So I don't know that I can adequately represent the whole environmental science community in that. I think that there was a whole series of studies that reached alternative, different conclusions right now. So I think the answer is we probably don't know whether oil and gas emissions are flat or increasing. Currently, I think that there's a couple of problems with that. One of them is that the way that you determine the presence of natural gas is either by using it in conjunction with ethane. So if you see methane with ethane, that's generally thermogenic, and if you don't, you think it's biogenic. And the other one is a delta.
Could you define those terms for our audience?
What?
Thermogenic.
Oh, so thermogenic is old methane. Basically, it's come from kerogen that's been is being degraded down in shale layers or in substrata of the earth. Okay, it started out as very long chained hydrocarbons, getting shorter and shorter and shorter. Okay, and eventually it stops at methane, and that's in CO2, and that's what comes out. And so that's the thermogenic part. Biogenic is being recycled inside of our current environment. So that's plants, animals, and so on. Okay. So I think the answer is unknown right now, and there's been studies in both directions, that have been global studies, not the kind I do, but global type studies, satellite type information. Some say it's flat, some say it's not. I think we just don't know.
One follow up question that I'm going to ask based on your question is, and we forgot to repeat what your question.
Oh,
was,
sorry.
We're supposed to do, okay. Which the question was, that. Though the oil and gas industry says that methane emissions are declining, there have been recent studies that have found that there is, in fact, a spike. So what's going on? So I wrote a story earlier this year about some shortcomings in the detection methods when you are trying to detect methane leaks in extremely cold and windy environments. Now, my story focused on the North Slope, which has seen declines in oil production in recent years, though that's about to change. But it also dealt with what's happening in the Alberta tar sands. And I'm curious if, I talked to people doing some measurements up there who were like, when the wind blows, which it always does, we sometimes have a really hard time getting any solid measurements. Could what's happening on the tar sands have any impact on any potential spike, do you think?
So I think a lot of the screening that's being done in the natural gas industry isn't actually contributing to any kind of global accounting of the emissions, right? Mm-hmm. So that's basically a control process is going on inside of those companies, right? So I don't think that that's necessarily helping us do a better estimate,
okay.
For one. Okay. So the second thing, though, is, are the control actions reducing emissions the way we would like them to? That's, I think we continually find that there are holes in the methods, right? So there are cases where we think we're finding everything and we're not. Okay. And I'll give you a real practical example. So a colleague of mine and a couple from different universities and Google Street View cars are equipped with methane sensors, and they drive around. You've all seen the pictures of the spikes and stuff like that. Okay, and there's utilities now that are trying to use this to get it into their sort of standard patrol for emissions. And what they're finding is that the car finds things that the sniffer type detections didn't find, and the sniffer finds things that the car doesn't do, right? And this is the same thing I was saying earlier about the multi-level emissions. We actually, if you do one thing, you never know, okay? So you have to do this sort of multiple scale thing, or you will never know what the emissions
are. Can I ask a question that follows up on that question, which is related to both what we discussed, and I don't mean to monopolize the questions here, but how certain can we be about these emissions counts? I mean, it seems like a black box. And, in the study that I was referring mm-hmm. to by these scientists at Harvard that came out this year, they have something like an 18% margin of error in their estimates. And these margins of error can be substantial. So how do we really know that our emissions are rising or falling in either places as local as a state or on a national level?
Right. So actually, if anybody gives you an emissions estimate that's tighter than 18%, you should be suspicious. Okay? We're flat out. We're not that good. Okay?
That's a problem.
Okay, so probably if you look at facility level emissions, the best technique out there, in my humble opinion right now, is called tracer flux, dual tracer flux. So you release a gas on site. You know what the gas is. It's not normally on the site. Say, think acetylene. You measure it downwind. You know how much of that you released. You compare the amount you released to the amount of the target analyte, methane in this case. Okay, and you ratio those two, and that tells you how much it's emitting. That technique, which is probably the best controlled, is plus or minus 30%.
Okay? And the problem is, though, that this isn't happening on a broad scale. Maybe specialized utilities or certain agencies might do this on an episodic basis, but when my state, Massachusetts, actually tries to enumerate whether we are going to comply with our law of cutting greenhouse gases 25% below 1990 levels, they're making it up. They don't. They're estimating. They're not measuring. They're not setting sensors at the tops of buildings and actually measuring what's in the atmosphere. They are using formulas that are probably not accurate.
Yeah, I think the emission, using an emission count is a tough way to get a good estimate, right? So you need to constrain it with both top-down and bottom-up.
We have, I saw two, three, four, five hands. So I'm going to start with the gentleman in the blue shirt in the back and then move to the woman in front of him.
Thank you. My apologies. Chris Clayton, I'm an agriculture journalist with BP and the Progressive Farmer.
Chris Clayton, an agricultural journalist with
DT and the Progressive Farmer.
Thank you. We're repeating this because these microphones are being used to record the session, not to help you hear.
And I wanted to ask you about nitrous oxide emissions. Agricultural fertilizer, 85% of the fertilizer is natural gas. These emissions, based maybe on old EPA data, are 298 times higher than carbon. So how much significance is maybe the difference between nitrous oxide emissions compared to methane emissions from these leaks? Can you give me some sort of contrast of what's the more potent problem?
So the difference between nitrous oxides, sulfur oxide. Oh, sorry. I don't know if I can repeat that question. So the question was around the impact of nitrous oxide in terms of climate change, correct, versus the impact of, say, methane, other gases in climate change, correct? Am I summarizing?
Because natural gas is the dominant
right.
Right.
So there's a couple of parts of your question. One of them is the natural gas is the primary ingredient. So that, hold that question. I'll come back to that. The second question was the impact of nitrous oxide. So the thing about nitrous oxides is that we have been trying to reduce nitrous oxides for quite a while. That's been in our hazardous air pollutant portfolio.
Can you say what nitrous oxide is and where it comes from?
Tailpipes. Okay, so it's a tailpipe emission. It's when nitrogen in the air interacts with your fuel, combines with an oxygen, and it comes out with various nitrous oxides, NOx, as we call them. So because there's been more control on it, that, you know, even though it has a higher global warming potential, there's more constraint on it. So I think the last numbers I saw was somewhere around 0.15 watts per meter squared versus methane is around 0.48. So it's about one-third of the impact or so on, you know, best estimates IPCC sort of area. Now, the other question you ask is methane is a big – or natural gas is a big ingredient. Most fertilizer comes from natural gas, okay? And so there's a couple of processes going on in that chain of events, right? So natural gas is used to produce high pressures at those sites. It's also – a reactant that generates the fertilizer. There's a paper in review right now that actually says that there's a massive underestimate of how much methane is being released from fertilizer plants. Okay. So, but it's not out yet.
Thank you.
This was a similar problem with detection.
Could you please?
Oh, Nadia White, I'm the University of Montana School of Journalism. Okay.
I'm sorry, but I could not.
University of Montana School of Journalism.
Thank you.
Environmental Journalism Graduate Program. I took a bunch of students last year to Fukushima to do some post-reporting of their incidents. And is this a case there? They empowered people with sensors. This was a major issue of trust in Fukushima. You can't see radioactive contamination. And that the government was not trusted. And there's a lot of questions about how you're testing and where you're testing. What's not being reported. So a group empowered this vast network of hand sensors that were real-time, recorded in real-time. And part of what you guys are saying about detection is that you can't test everywhere at once, and the other is that the technology doesn't necessarily work. Is there solving the first part of that problem, having a lot of people with Google car-type sensors, hand sniffers, does anybody do that? Is there a role for citizen science? Is there a role for citizen journalism in this?
I actually read a story about...
Would you repeat the question?
Citizen science, is there a role for it?
Is there a role for citizen science in detecting natural gas leaks. I wrote a story earlier this year about this collaboration between students at MIT, environmental advocates, and the utilities in creating this device, which they call a flux bar, that they claim is far better at actually detecting these emissions. And they and some of the companies, actually Columbia Gas, which is the company that seems to have fucked up badly in Lawrence, excuse my language, and they have bought a bunch of these, and they're using them in lots of places and claim that there is a better, it helps them detect larger gas leaks, the so-called super emitters. You know, the evidence is, I don't know.
But, I mean, you also have, I mean, there are examples across the country where there's citizen science going on. And I think there's, of course, I think there's a place for that as long as you know what the limitations are, right? So the issue with the flare cameras that I was looking at wasn't that they weren't working. It was that under these very extreme, specific situations, they might not work all the time. Does that mean they shouldn't be used at all while they remain the best, most available technology? Of course not. It just means you need to know what you're looking at, because if you think you're getting the full picture, you're not. But necessarily. But in these situations, like we've reported at Inside Climate News on emissions on the Eagle Ford Shale, for instance, we did a big project a few years ago. There was a lot of citizen science that went into that, or scientists working with locals on the ground to go out and try and combat what the industry was saying about emissions. It's just all about knowing the limitations, much like knowing the assumptions that the scientists are making.
I want to interject.
Remind people we have 19 minutes. Right. And
yeah, I want to interject something on here, though. So I think that one of the big things that's happened in the last few years is that oil and gas companies realize that they're not going to operate unless they have a social license to operate. Okay, so believe me, they've internalized that. And so, but what we haven't seen is that the research funders still don't think that there's a sociological component to these problems. And so when we pitch projects,
what do you mean?
Getting people involved, getting citizens involved, having engagement that would actually be substantive community engagement. So when we pitch projects like that, we can never get anybody to fund them. Because when I go with my sociology colleagues to that, the funders, the Department of Energy, they never see it as a cross, as a techno-social problem or a socio-techno problem.
Thank you very much. In the back, please, woman in gray.
Right here. I'm Addie Blair. I teach environmental journalism at Miami University of Ohio.
Addie Blair, who teaches environmental journalism at
Miami University.
Thank you.
I have what's probably a very elemental question, but if, as Sabrina especially was talking about, if businesses understand that leaking methane is a loss for them, a revenue downside, then who is pushing for these rollbacks on the regulations, and how are businesses actually viewing that?
It's not such a basic question. The question was if industry views dealing with methane leaks as there's a business imperative to do that, then why are these regulations being rolled back? As the cost of natural gas has gone down, I think the industry has maybe been a little bit less amenable to some of those regulatory changes. I'll hand this off to Dan in a second because he can talk about the industries
yep.
that exist, but. But, it does seem that there is this impression within the Trump administration that, like, regulation equals bad, therefore get rid of it, especially as it pertains to regulations that came about under the umbrella of Obama and climate change. I think that's a part of it, is kind of that there's, especially without having a rigorous scientific body that has the ear of the White House, it may just be like, oh yeah, oh, that thing, like, get rid of that. There's no way the industry likes that. Yeah. I'll let you take it away.
So two quick points. First one is, with a few exceptions, natural gas is an accident from the point of view of the oil and gas operators. They're after condensate, they're after oil, and the gas is extra. And that's why the price is so low. They're going to drill anyway because they're after the condensate. So keep that in mind. The second part of that is I work with a more progressive part of the oil and gas industry, and they are not in favor of the rollback of any regulations because they want stability. Not one of them believes that these are going to stay rolled back forever. They would like, you know, some sort of stable regulatory environment.
One of them has said that publicly. No oil company has
said they're not going to either. Yes, yeah. But across the pier, you'll hear it.
Okay, we've got 15 minutes and a large number of hands. This gentleman first, and then ma'am, you're next.
Okay, I'm Chuck Kutcher from the University of Colorado at Boulder and also Solar Today magazine. Dan, first of all, thank you for the excellent data that you take. It's important to have that information. It really comes down to comparing natural gas and coal. If we look at your numbers and we take that 3% break-even point and you're like at 2% or 2.7%, whatever, what you're sort of saying is that at best, natural gas is marginally better than coal. I would argue, though, that the 3% number that's commonly used is not a good number. And why isn't it a good number? It compares the very worst coal plants to the very best natural gas plants. So it looks at a simple pulverized coal.
Can you take
a
mic? Because you've got a long...
That's okay. I'm just trying to make sure that the transcript...
So that 3% number compares a very dirty pulverized coal plant to the best combined cycle high efficiency natural gas plant. A lot of natural gas is burned in combustion turbines at lower efficiency. So that number favors natural gas over coal. That's number one. Number two, it generally uses the 100-year global warming potential for methane, even though you had a slide that said it's weighted, whatever that means. The reports that I've seen, it uses 100-year, which favors natural gas. It ignores leaks in the pipeline, which David talked about. So it only looks at leaks centrally, not in the whole distribution system of these old pipelines. And a lot of these studies are funded by the natural gas industry. So for all those reasons, I think that 3% break-even number is a number that the natural gas industry favors, and I don't think it's realistic. Could you comment on those concerns?
So the number I quoted is from a paper by Ramon Alvarez at EDF. Okay, and he looked at total leakage rates. And to be honest, I don't know the paper. I don't have the paper in my head enough to know what class of plant he looked at for natural gas. And that's the best peer-reviewed comparison I've seen. That doesn't mean there isn't space for another one. Okay, but that's the one I've been using. So that's an EDF number.
The woman in the back.
So my name is Judy Faze. I'm a reporter with KUER News, the NPR affiliate in Salt Lake City. So my question is twofold. One is, and Dan, you were starting to refer to this, I think. It seems like the state regulation is really different from the federal regulation in most of the states. And I've been a little confused about... you know, when I heard about the methane rollback, I was like, well, but all of our guys are already doing these things. So I was really confused, and maybe you could clarify that. The other thing is for all of you, is to suggest ideas for stories that people like me could be doing to sort of capture this idea on a more local level about climate change and methane pollution and you know, methane in our midst kind of thing. So thank you.
Can you repeat the question?
She was on mic.
Yeah, I was mic. You're good. Thank
to the you. Rest of you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can take part two. You want to take part one?
Part one.
States.
States. Okay, states. You're right to be confused. Okay. So California, Colorado, Pennsylvania have some pretty active programs. There's a couple states that are sort of like tier two. They travel around behind that a little bit. Then there's the hell no, we won't do anything. And then there's sort of the socialist north kind of, you know, semi-socialist north, like North Dakota. They have sort of their completely different vector. So, yeah, you're right to be confused.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, I've reported on that specifically, like with coal ash at one point I was reporting on. And, you know, what kind of the Trump administration and more conservative governments have wanted is, like, for the states to be able to control their own regulations. And there are arguments for that. Each state has a different kind of situation as it pertains to extraction. That said, it allows for a lot of wiggle room. And so you'll see this kind of great variety. Now, when it comes to, like, locals and what you can be reporting on at home, I think that is such a key way to look at this, because we know that what's emitted locally impacts everything globally. And so finding a way to tell that story to your home audience is the way really to land these pieces. And so that may be, you know, it was just sort of handed to you because things keep blowing up over there.
Well, yeah, but before the things started blowing up, which is a perennial problem, it seems, there are many more than I mentioned. But, you know, look at what the utility is required to report to the state. And can you map those gas leaks? We were able to look at gas leaks in every community in Massachusetts. And while Boston, of course, had the most because it's the largest city and has the most network of pipes, there were small communities that had an exorbitant amount. And people who live there would probably like to know that. And so you should look at those reports. I don't know if they're required in your state. They are in mine. And you can also look at potentially how long those leaks have been there.
We have 9 minutes left. Gentleman in the back.
Sorry. Yeah. I thought it was next.
No, one and two.
All right. Derek Jackson with the Union of Concerned Scientists and a former colleague of David's at the Boston Globe.
I'm sorry, sir, but I could not hear your name.
Derek Jackson with the Union of Concerned Scientists.
Thank you.
Given the Northeast is, of course, a part of the country where utilities are trying to build multi-billion-dollar pipelines to take advantage of Appalachian gas, given if the utilities were able to actually get through this whole new wave of natural gas pipelines, have you remotely begun to think about the methane impact on the atmosphere between new pipelines construction, the old pipelines that have all these leaks, and production at source?
So, would you repeat the question?
So I think the question is, you know, with gas is flowing in a different direction now, so there's been an interest in building pipelines into, for example, the Northeast, to utilize gas from the Marcellus or Pennsylvania more locally than the current pathways. You know, I'm not sure every one of these is its own sort of bucket, you know, so it's hard to do blanket statements that say something about all of it. That said, I said that the actual gas transmission system is pretty darn tight because it's at such high pressure. It doesn't leak very often, and when it does start leaking, it tends to go from leak to detonation very, very quickly. And so it's a very tightly monitored system. So in that sense, you're probably not going to change emissions much if you're going to be burning the gas anyway someplace else. Whether it's burned in the Northeast or it's burned someplace else, it's not going to change it very much. In fact, you could even argue that since your pipelines now are coming up from Louisiana, you might even reduce emissions by some tiny amount because it's moving less distance. Okay. That said, the problem with pipelines is not a global problem. It's a local problem. It's in somebody's backyard. You know, it's always a case-by-case basis.
Thank you. Sir?
My name is James Sims. I'm a freelance journalist and commentator based in Japan. Question, looks like we're talking about basically pipeline-based gas.
Yep.
I was wondering in terms of LNG, which most of Asia, China, Japan, Korea, are the biggest importers of LNG, Australia, Indonesia, Middle East. I was wondering in terms of the emissions impact from LNG, looking at, you know, from production to actual transportation.
Yeah, so the question is about emissions from LNG and how that compares to other parts of the system. So LNG, because it has to be liquefied, requires a fair bit of energy to liquefy it. That's generating greenhouse gas in and of itself. So if you didn't ever liquefy it, you're not generating those greenhouse gases, that's for sure. Beyond that, there's been very little measurement of LNG. So in theory, it should be very tight, okay? And if it's transported on ships correctly, the gas can go into the engine, okay, and be used, so it shouldn't leak much during transport. But we actually don't know. There's not been much done.
Which jives with what some of my reporting has shown recently, as it seemed more and more likely that the Trans-Alaska pipeline might be, you know, added to so that it could be transporting LNG from the North Slope. And I've been trying to find out what the climate impact of that might be. The answer I keep getting is, no idea.
So let me put in one other thing about LNG, though. And so I do a lot of work in Africa. So I'm over in Africa a couple times a year, particularly East Africa. And one of the interesting stories about LNG is that they're exporting it from one of the most energy-poor continents in the world, okay, to the more energy-rich places in the world. Okay, and so LNG has an environmental justice aspect to it that has not been explored very well.
Mozambique
is my poster child for that, right?
Yeah. I've gotten the signal that we have about 4 minutes. I think we could do one quick question. Someone who has not asked a question in the past. Yes, ma'am. I saw your.
Hi there. I'm Susan Moran, a freelance journalist based in Boulder, Colorado. And by the way, Colorado State University will be our host next year. We have a lot more of Dan.
We'll even take you out to my $4 million fake well sites.
So, quick question about federal funding. For things like the tall flux towers that are measuring methane and all kinds of other things in certain areas, it seems like there's been a defunding of a lot of things, but particularly measuring.
So I think the question is on what the state of funding is for research, particularly. Yeah, for research. Yeah, and what we had a fairly active season of research grants in June of 2016, and we have seen nothing since. That doesn't mean there's going to be zero, but right now it's been very light on the federal funding side. California's been pretty active. Canada's very active right now. There's a couple of industry groups that have pooled money. You know, so there's some stuff going on, but the federal has been quiet since June of 2016.
I just want to repeat or emphasize something that we've discussed a little bit, but if there is one takeaway that you guys walk out of here with, and this was a hugely helpful thing in having conversations with my colleagues here, it's always a challenge in writing, or has been for me, comparing the potency of carbon dioxide to methane. And just, you know, a data point that we discussed last night and we discussed a little bit here, the way to describe it is now simple to me, and I'm presuming I'm going to say this accurately. So when you're comparing carbon dioxide to methane, one simple way of describing it is that methane is 34 times more powerful than carbon dioxide over a century. That's according to the latest figures by the IPCC, or 86 times more powerful than carbon dioxide over 20 years. So just a factoid that I think everybody could walk away with.
Yeah, it's editor-friendly.
Yes.
I think we should call it quits. We do have some handouts here, and I know that the panelists will be willing to stay a little bit as long as you don't get between down the food line.
That's right.
Thank you very much.